He'd been part of the first attempt to colonize Roanoke 2 years earlier, an attempt that failed when the colonists, all men, ran desperately short of supplies and hitched a ride back to England with Sir Francis Drake, who, as fate would have it, had decided to anchor nearby during a break from raiding Spanish ships. "This time round," Henry said, "Raleigh's plan was more ambitious. Instead of brusque sailors, he sent young families that would put down roots, produce children, build churches and schoolhouses. It was his opportunity to build a New England and the New World. For Etiva and me, it was an opportunity to leave a home that held little in the way of happiness. All told, we were 90 men, 9 children, and 17 women, including John White's own daughter, Eleanor Dare." Eleanor, who was 8 months pregnant, was joined by her husband Ananias aboard the Lion. She was an uncommonly pretty 24-year-old, with a shock of red hair and freckled face. One can only imagine the discomfort she felt as the 120-ton ship pitched about in the oppressive July heat, heat that turned the innards of the ships into giant steam ovens. "Even some of the surest-footed sailors found themselves green-faced and bent over the railings when the seas kicked up and the sun beat down on us." The first of the two deaths occurred on Sunday, May 24th, a little more than 2 weeks after the colonists set sail from Plymouth. A ship's mate named Bloom had been in the crow's nest at night, charged with keeping a sharp eye out for distant silhouettes on the star-filled horizon. Spanish carracks, with a reputation for attacking and pillaging English ships, were a very real threat. Shortly after midnight, the ship's pilot, Simon Ferdinando, who'd already gained fame through previous expeditions to Maine and Virginia, recalled hearing a crash on the main deck. Moments later, he found himself standing over the lifeless body of Mr. Bloom, whose neck was severely broken. "Mr. Ferdinando thought it strange that an experienced sailor, particularly one who'd sworn off drink, could have taken such a fall in calm seas. But such was life on the Atlantic. Accidents happened. Other than a few prayers for the unfortunate man's soul, little was said about Mr. Bloom among the passengers and crew." Captain White recorded the matter rather succinctly and dispassionately in his log. "Man fell from crow's nest, dead, thrown overboard. Had that been the only incident during our crossing, we might have counted ourselves fortunate. But our nerves were tested again on Tuesday, June 30th, when Elizabeth Barrington vanished into the night forever." Elizabeth, an almost comically short, curly-haired girl of 16, had been literally dragged aboard by her father and several shipmates, kicking, screaming, and biting the whole way. To her, the Lion was a prison ship. Months earlier, she had fallen hard for a young clerk in her father's law practice. Knowing that the match would never warrant approval, the two young lovers carried on a secret affair, the discovery of which caused a minor sensation in the Inns of Court and severely damaged the reputation of her father among his fellow solicitors. Embarrassed, Mr. Barrington seized the opportunity to start a new life across the Atlantic and dragged his insolent daughter along for good measure. That Tuesday, the weather grew ever violent as our caravan sailed into a wall of storm clouds. By nightfall, all but a few deckhands had retreated below to escape the pounding wind and rain. The ship was tossed so severely that Captain White ordered all candles snuffed for fear that the waves could knock one over and start a fire. With Etiva in my arms, I huddled in total darkness below deck, felt the dizzying motion of the ship, heard the groans of wooden planks and fellow passengers being sick. I know that Elizabeth Barrington had been there with us when the lights went out. I had seen her myself, but she was not there in the morning. The storm had passed, and the sun had returned to its oppressive perch. Because Elizabeth often kept to herself below, it wasn't until mid-morning that anyone noticed her absence. Passengers called her name but received no answer. A full search of the ship turned up nothing. A second search, which included bags of flour being emptied and barrels of gunpowder sifted through, was likewise fruitless. She was gone. Captain White made another succinct and dispassionate entry in his log. Girl fell overboard in a storm. Dead. Privately, we all knew that the unhappy girl had taken her own life, that she had leapt into the sea and drowned. Prayers were said for her soul, though we knew it to be condemned to hell, suicide being an unforgivable sin in the eyes of God. The last 3 weeks of their voyage were free of further accidents and blessed with better weather. Even so, the sight of dry land was an especially welcome one. The colonists set about felling trees, rebuilding abandoned shelters, planting crops, and making contact with the natives, particularly the Croatoan, who'd welcomed the English in the past. But this time, their truce proved short-lived. Exactly 1 week after the first of John White's ships landed on Roanoke Island, one of his colonists, George Howe, was found face down in the shallow waters of Albemarle Sound. He'd been fishing alone when a group of savages took him by surprise. White pieced the attack together based on the evidence at the scene. From his log, "These savages being secretly hidden among high reeds, where oftentimes they find the deer asleep, and so kill them, espied our man wading in the water alone, almost naked, without any weapon, save only a small forked stick, catching crabs therewithal, and also being strayed 2 miles from his company, and shot at him in the water, where they gave him 16 wounds with their arrows, and after they had slain him with their wooden swords, they beat his head in pieces and fled over the water." White concluded that Howe was shot with 16 arrows, because the body had 16 small puncture wounds in it. In truth, no arrows were found in or near Mr. Howe. Governor White also omitted an important detail from his record, that the body had already begun to decompose, even though Mr. Howe had only been dead several hours before being discovered. On August 18th, the colony turned its thoughts from the Croatoan and rejoiced at the arrival of its first baby, Virginia Dare, John White's granddaughter. She was the first English baby born in the New World, and like her mother, possessed a shock of red hair. The birth was attended by the colony's only doctor, Thomas Crowley. Crowley was a plump, balding man of 56, tall in stature. He had a kind, pockmarked face, and a well-known love of jokes. For this and his skill as a physician, he was held in high regard, and few things gave him greater thrill than making a patient forget his troubles in laughter. Satisfied that his colony was off to a strong start, the unpleasantness of Mr. Howe's demise notwithstanding, John White sailed back to England to report on their progress and bring back supplies. He left behind 113 men, women, and children, including his infant grandchild, Virginia. If all went well, he would return in several months with food, building materials, and goods to trade with the natives. All did not go well. A series of events conspired to keep John White in England for the next 3 years. First, his crew refused to sail back during the dangerous winter months. The summer crossing had been dangerous and deadly enough. Unable to find a replacement crew, White endured what must have been a maddening, worrisome winter. By the time spring finally arrived, England was at war with Spain, and Queen Elizabeth needed every worthy ship at her disposal. That included the vessels White had planned to take back to the New World. He scrambled and found a pair of smaller, older ships that Her Majesty didn't require. But shortly into the voyage, both of these were captured and plundered by Spanish pirates. With no supplies left for his colonists, White turned around and headed back to England. The war with Spain raged on for 2 more years, leaving John White stranded in his home country, endlessly frustrated. In 1590, having given up on bringing back supplies, he was finally able to secure passage on a merchant ship. On August 18th, his granddaughter Virginia's third birthday, he set foot on Roanoke Island once again. They were gone. Every last man, woman, and child, his daughter, his baby granddaughter, the Barringtons, gone. His colony had simply vanished into thin air. The buildings remained exactly as they had been, though weather-beaten and overgrown. Tools and supplies were exactly where they belonged. Surrounded by rich soil and abundant wildlife, how could they have starved? If there was some kind of pestilence, where were the mass graves? If there was a battle, where were signs? It didn't make any sense. There were only two clues of any note. The word Croatoan carved into one of the fence posts of the perimeter wall, and the letters CRO carved into the bark of a nearby tree. Had the Croatoan attacked the colony? It seemed unlikely. They would have burned it to the ground, for one thing. And there would be bodies. Evidence. Something. White guessed, or hoped anyway, that the cryptic carvings meant the colonists, for whatever reason, had resettled on nearby Croatoan Island. But he wouldn't get a chance to prove his theory. The weather was taking a turn for the worse, and the crew of his merchant ship refused to remain any longer. After 3 years spent trying to return, and only a few hours on dry land, he was given a choice: return to England and try to mount another expedition, or be left to fend for himself on a strange continent with no idea where his countrymen were, or if they were alive at all. White sailed away, never to set foot in the New World again. He spent the rest of his days haunted by grief, guilt, and above all, bewilderment over the disappearance of his 113 colonists. "I think," said Henry, "that it is better he never learned the truth." Shortly after Governor White's first return to England, the people of Roanoke were beset by a strange illness, which produced an acute fever in its victims. This fever led to delusions, coma, and eventually death. Dr. Crowley thought the disease a native one. He was powerless to curb its effects. In the 3 months following Governor White's departure, 10 of us succumbed to this plague. In the 3 months after that, a dozen more. Their bodies were carried a distance into the woods and buried, lest the sickness contaminate the soil near our settlement. We grew ever more fearful that ours would be the next body carried off. A near constant vigil was kept on the island's eastern shore, in hopes that sails would soon be spotted there. But none were. It is likely that things would have continued thus, had not the hideous discovery been made. Eleanor Dare couldn't sleep, not while her husband fought for his life a mere 50 yards away. She dressed, wrapped sleeping baby Virginia in a blanket, and walked through the freezing air to Dr. Crowley's building, resigned to spending the rest of her restless night by his side in prayer. Upon entering, Mrs. Dare was met with the ghastly sight of Crowley, with his mouth around her husband's neck. He withdrew and presented his fangs, drawing screams from her. Thus alerted, several of our men ran into Crowley's building with their swords and crossbows, only to find the woman slaughtered and the infant Virginia in the vampire's claws. Crowley warned the men to retreat. They refused. Having no knowledge of vampires, the men perished at once. Their screams woke the rest of the colonists, including Henry. I dressed and told Etiva to do the same, thinking it was an attack by the natives. I charged into the night with my pistol, determined to protect my home to the last. But on reaching the clearing in the center of our village, I was met with an incredible sight, a terrifying sight. Thomas Crowley, his eyes black, a pair of white razors in his mouth, tearing Jack Barrington in half, spilling his innards everywhere. I saw friends scattered on the ground, some with limbs missing, some with heads missing. Crowley took notice of me and advanced. I leveled my pistol and fired. The ball found its mark, piercing the center of his chest, but this failed to slow him in the least. He continued to advance. I'm not ashamed to admit that all courage left me. I could think only of escape, only of Edeva and the unborn child in her belly. Henry turned and ran the 50 yards home as fast as he could. Edeva was already waiting in the doorway, and he hardly slowed as he grabbed her hand and continued toward the tree line. The coast! Let us make haste to the coast! I could hear him running behind us, each step breaking the earth, each one closer than the last. We ran into the trees, ran until our lungs burn, until Edeva began to slow, and I felt his steps behind us. We will never see the coast. I remember none of it, only that I woke on my stomach and knew at once that my wounds were mortal. My body lay shattered, my limbs all but useless, dried blood over my eyes rendering me half blind. By the sound of Edeva's labored breath, I knew that she was even closer to the end than I. She lay on her side, her yellow dress stained with blood, her yellow hair matted with it. I dragged myself to her with two broken arms, dragged my eyes close to hers, open and distant. I ran my hand through her hair and simply looked at her, simply watched her breathing slow, all the while whispering, "Don't be afraid, love." And then she stopped. By sunrise, Crowley had dragged most of his fellow settlers into the woods. He'd been left no alternative. Explaining a plague was easy, almost as easy as explaining a man falling from a crow's nest, or a girl jumping overboard, or a fisherman being attacked by savages. But screams in the night, followed by the disappearance of 4 men, a woman, and an infant? That he couldn't explain. They would question him, discover him, and that he couldn't have. One by one, he dragged their battered bodies away. Of his 112 fellow settlers, only one had been spared his wrath. Crowley had hesitated to kill Virginia Dare, a baby that he had personally delivered, the first English soul born in the New World. These things had sentimental value. Besides, she would have no memory of what had happened here, and a young female companion might prove useful in the lonely years to come. He returned from the woods with the baby in his arms. I dare say he was surprised to see me alive, though barely so, struggling to keep my feet while I carved the letters CRO into a tree with a knife, my dying effort to expose the identity of my murderer, of my wife and child's murderer. His shock subsided. Crowley could not help his laughter, for I had unwittingly given him a brilliant idea. Setting the baby down and taking my knife, he carved the word Croatoan onto a nearby post, all while smiling at the thought of John White massacring scores of unsuspecting natives in retaliation. Crowley prepared to take Henry's head, but here he hesitated again. He was suddenly struck by the realization that he would then be the only English-speaking man for 3,000 miles in any direction, a lonely prospect for one with such a love of jokes. Who then to laugh at them? I watched him kneel over me and cut his wrist with a fingernail, letting the blood spill over my face and into my mouth. Crowley buried the last of the colonists and headed south toward the Spanish territories, carrying a crying baby in one arm and the half-dead body of a young Henry in the other. Soon, after the sickness and the hallucinations passed, after his bones mended themselves, his companion would open his eyes to a new life in a new world. But first, Thomas Crowley would celebrate by feasting on the first English blood born to it. He had decided to feast on Virginia Dare. 6. 21 days after Henry carried him into the house unconscious, Abe was well enough to leave his room and take a tour of the house. I was astonished to find that my windowless room was, in fact, part of a windowless house, a house dug entirely out of the earth, its walls and floors meticulously lined with stone and clay, a kitchen where he had prepared my food on the wood stove, a library where he had replenished my supply of books, a second bedchamber, all lit by oil light, and all decorated with elegant furnishings and gold frame paintings, as if Henry thought these his windows to the outside world. "This," said Henry, "this has been my purpose these past 7 years, building this home, one shovelful of dirt at a time." All four rooms centered on a small stairwell. Here was the only place lit in part by the sun, its soft light streaming down from above. Here were the wooden stairs that I had heard Henry climb up and down, countless times. We followed them up to a flimsy wooden door, sunlight squeaking through the cracks. Opening it and stepping through, I was surprised to find myself standing in a small log cabin. This was modestly furnished, complete with a working wood stove, rug, and bed. Henry donned a pair of spectacles with dark lenses as we stepped into the day. Now I could see the genius of his design, for from the outside, his home looked nothing more than a modest cabin on a lonely wooded hillside. "Shall we then?" asked Henry. So began the only real schooling Abraham Lincoln ever had. Every morning for the next 4 weeks, Abe and Henry climbed the stairs to the false cabin. Every day, Henry taught him something more about finding and fighting vampires. Every night, theory was put into practice as Henry challenged Abe to hunt him in the dark. Gone were my cloves of garlic and flasks of holy water. Gone were my knives. What remained were my stakes, my axe, and my mind. It was this last weapon which Henry spent the majority of his time improving, teaching me how to hide from a vampire's animal senses, how to use its quickness to my advantage, how to drive it from hiding, and how to kill it without putting my limbs and neck at risk. But for all of Henry's lessons, nothing was more valuable than the time we spent trying to kill each other. At first, I had been astonished by his speed and strength, convinced there was no way I would ever be its equal. Over time, however, I noticed that it took him longer and longer to subdue me. I even found myself landing the occasional strike. Soon it was not uncommon for me to best him 3 times out of 10. "I find myself in a curious position," said Henry after Abe had managed to pin him one night. "I feel rather like a rabbit that has taken a fox for its pupil." Abe smiled. "And I like a mouse who has taken a cat for its tutor." Early autumn came, and with it an end to Abe's stay. He and Henry stood outside the false cabin in the morning sun, Henry with his dark glasses, Abe carrying a few belongings and food for his journey. He was already weeks overdue at Little Pigeon Creek, and likely to get a thrashing from his father for coming home without the money he'd promised to earn. Henry, however, saw fit to remedy this with the gift of $25, 5 more than I'd promised my father. Naturally, pride demanded I refuse this gift as too generous. Naturally, Henry's pride demanded I accept it. I did, and thanked him profusely. There was much I had thought of saying at this moment, thanking him for his kindness and his hospitality, thanking him for saving my life, for teaching me how to preserve it in the future. I thought of apologizing for the harshness with which I had first judged him. However, none of this proved necessary, for Henry quickly extended a hand and said, "Let us say goodbye, then say no more." We shook hands and I was off. But there was something I had forgotten to ask, something I had wondered since we first met. I turned back to him. "Henry, what were you doing at the river that night?" He looked strangely stern upon hearing this, more so than I had seen him the whole of my stay. "There is no honor in taking sleeping children from their beds," he said, "or feasting upon the innocent. I have given you the means of delivering punishment to those who do. In time, I shall give you their names." With that, he turned and walked back toward the cabin. "Judge us not equally, Abraham. We may all deserve hell, but some of us deserve it sooner than others." 4. A Truth Too Terrible. The autocrat of all the Russias will resign his crown and proclaim his subjects free republicans sooner than will our American masters voluntarily give up their slaves. Abraham Lincoln in a letter to George Robertson, August 15, 1855. 1. My dear sister is gone. In 1826, Sarah Lincoln had married Little Pigeon Creek neighbor Aaron Grigsby, 6 years her senior. The couple had moved into a cabin close to both of their families, and within 9 months announced that they were expecting a child. Shortly after she went into labor on January 20, 1828, Sarah had begun to lose an unusual amount of blood. Rather than fetch help, Aaron had tried to deliver the baby himself, too frightened to leave his wife's side. By the time he'd realized how grave the situation was and run for a doctor, it was too late. Sarah was 20 years old. She and the stillborn baby boy were buried together in the Little Pigeon Baptist Church Cemetery. On hearing the news, Abe sobbed uncontrollably. It was as if he'd lost his mother all over again. On hearing the details of his brother-in-law's hesitation, Abe's grief was joined by rage. "The no-good son of a bitch let her lie there and die. For this, I shall never forgive him." Never turned out to be only a few short years. Aaron Grigsby died in 1831. By the time he turned 19, Abraham Lincoln had covered nearly every inch of every page in his journal with ink, in ever smaller lettering as he neared the end. It held 7 years of remarkable records, insights into his disdain for his father, his hatred of vampires, accounts of his earliest battles with the walking dead. It also held no fewer than 16 folded letters between its pages. The first had arrived barely a month after Abe left Henry's cabin and returned to Little Pigeon Creek. "Dear Abraham, I trust this finds you well. Below is the name of someone who deserves it sooner. You will find him in the town of Rising Sun, 3 days upriver from Louisville. Do not construe this letter as an expectation of action. The choice is yours, always. I merely wish to offer the opportunity for continued study and provide some small measure of relief for the injustices done you, as you will no doubt seek their redress on your own." Beneath this was the name Silas Williams and the word cobbler. The letter was signed only with an H. Abe rode to Rising Sun a week later, telling his father that he was off to Louisville to look for work. "I had expected to find the place plagued by a rash of disappearances or pestilence of some sort. However, the people seemed in excellent spirits, and their town in excellent health. I walked among them with my weapons hidden beneath my long coat, for it had occurred to me that the sight of a tall stranger with an axe might engender concern among the citizenry. I intruded upon the kindness of a passerby, and asked where I might find the cobbler, for my shoes were very badly worn. Having been directed to a modest shop not more than 50 yards away, I entered and found a bearded, bespectacled man hard at work, his walls covered with worn and dismembered shoes. He was a meek creature of some 35 years, and he was alone. 'Silas Williams?' I asked. 'Yes.' I cut his head off with my axe and left. When his head fell to the floor, his eyes were as black as the shoes he had been polishing. I have not the faintest idea what his crimes were, nor do I care. I care only that there is one less vampire today than there was yesterday. It is strange, I admit, to think that I owe this fact to a vampire. However, it has long been said that my enemy's enemy is my friend. 15 more letters arrived in Little Pigeon Creek over the next 3 years, each with nothing more than a name, a place, and that unmistakable H. There were times that two would arrive in as many months. There were times that none arrived for 3 months' time. Regardless of when they came, I always set out as soon as my work would allow. Each hunt brought new lessons, new improvements to my skills and tools. Some were as effortless as the beheading of Silas Williams. Others saw me lying in wait for hours on end or posing as prey, only to turn the tables when the vampire attacked. Some required a day's ride or less. Others took me as far as Fort Wayne and Nashville. No matter how long the journey, he always carried the same items with him. In my bundle I carried whatever food I could, a pan for frying pork and a pot for boiling water. These were wrapped in my long coat, which I had paid a seamstress to further alter by removing the inside pockets and sewing a thick leather lining in their place. The whole was tied to the handle of my axe, which I kept sharp enough to shave my whiskers. I added a crossbow to this little arsenal too, one that I had fashioned myself using the drawings and a borrowed copy of Weapons of the Taborites as my guide. I continued to practice with it when time allowed, but dared not wield it in battle until my skills were much improved. While hunting vampires offered a surplus of vengeance, it paid nothing in the way of real money. As a young man, Abe was expected to help provide for his family, and in keeping with the customs of the time, any wages he earned belonged to his father until his 21st birthday. As one might imagine, this didn't sit well. The idea of handing my earnings to such a man, of my labor rewarding his lack thereof, of doing anything to benefit one so shiftless, so selfish and cowardly, it is no more than indentured servitude. Abe was always looking for a job, whether clearing trees, hauling grain, or ferrying passengers from the banks of the Ohio to waiting steamboats on a scow of his own construction. Footnote: Abe was amazed that passengers were willing to fork over a dollar apiece to have themselves ferried a distance of, in some cases, 30 feet. As in his days on the old Cumberland Trail in Kentucky, he also reveled in meeting travelers and hearing their stories, many of which he would retell for the rest of his life. In early May 1828, when Abe was still reeling from his sister's death, a job came looking for him for a change, one that would change his life. James Gentry owned one of the largest and most prosperous farms around Little Pigeon Creek. He'd been an acquaintance of Thomas Lincoln for the better part of 10 years, and was unlike him in just about every imaginable way. Naturally, Abe had always looked up to him on account of this. For his part, Gentry had come to admire the tall, hard-working, and modest Lincoln boy. His own son Alan was a few years older than Abe, but a pinch less mature. The industrious farmer wanted to expand his reach, and his profits, by selling his corn and bacon downriver in Mississippi, where sugar and cotton were king, but where other goods were in great demand. Mr. Gentry asked if I would join Alan in building and piloting a flatboat of his goods downriver, stopping in Mississippi and Point South to sell quantities of corn, pork, and other sundries. For this, he would pay me the sum of $8 each month and purchase my steamboat ticket home from New Orleans. It's likely Abe would have accepted this job even if there'd been no promise of money. It was a chance to escape, a chance for adventure. He put his axe, and in fairness, the carpentry skills he'd learned from his father, to work building a sturdy 40-foot flatboat from green oak, cutting each plank and fastening it to his frame with wooden pegs. He built a shelter in the middle of the deck, which he made big enough so that he could stand inside without fear of hitting his head on the ceiling. Inside were two beds, a small stove, and a lantern, as well as four small windows that could be shut in the event of attack. Finally, he coated the seams with pitch. Footnote: a tar-like resin, and fashioned a steering oar. Second footnote, a rudder with a long handle so it could be controlled from the roof of the shelter. At the risk of sounding proud, I must say that she turned out rather well, considering that she was the first I had ever built. Even when we burdened her with 10 tons of goods, she drew less than 2 feet of water. Alan and Abe launched their fully loaded flatboat on May 23rd. It was to be a journey of more than 1,000 miles. For Abe, it was to be his first glimpse of the Deep South. We battled winds and currents and kept an ever-vigilant eye on the river ahead. On many occasions, we were forced to free our modest vessel from mud or brush after running aground on a bank. We filled our bellies with the endless reserves of corn and pork on board and washed our clothes in the ever-present Mississippi when they grew offensive. For weeks this continued. Sometimes we covered as many as 60 miles in a day, sometimes 30 or less. The young men would holler with excitement when they crossed paths with a steamboat, those miraculous, gleaming sternwheelers puffing and splashing their way against the current. Their excitement would build at the sight of distant smoke rising from the river ahead, then crescendo as they approached and passed, shouting greetings and waving to passengers, pilots, and clerks. The noise of engines and churning water, black smoke rising from its chimney and white steam from its pipes. A boat that could take a man all the way from New Orleans to Louisville in under 25 days. Were there any limits to the ingenuity of man? This excitement having quieted, they would float for miles with nary a sound. It was a sort of peace I've rarely enjoyed since, as if we were the only two souls on earth, all of nature ours to enjoy. I wondered why a creator who had dreamt such beauty would have slandered it with such evil, such grief. Why he had not been content to leave it unspoilt. I still wonder. When the sun dipped out of sight, Alan and Abe would start looking for a suitable place to anchor, a town if possible. One night, not long after they'd passed through Baton Rouge, Lincoln and Gentry tied up on the Duchesne plantation, securing the flatboat to a tree with rope. As was their routine, the young men fried their supper, checked to see if the ropes were secure, and adjourned to their shelter. Here, they would read or talk until their eyes grew weary, snuff their lantern, and sleep in perfect darkness. I woke with a start and reached for the club that I kept near. Springing to my feet, I saw the trace of 2 figures in the doorway. I dare say they were a good deal surprised at my height, and a good deal more surprised by the ferocity with which I bludgeoned them about the head. I chased them, bludgeoning my own head on a crossbeam as I did, out onto the deck, where the moon revealed them in full. They were Negroes, 7 in all. The other 5 were busily trying to untie our boat. "Off with you devils," I cried, "before I brain the lot of you." To make them know my sincerity, I cracked another across his ribs and raised my club to crack another. This proved unnecessary. The Negroes fled. As they did, I chanced to see a broken pair of leg irons around one of their ankles and knew the truth at once. These were no common thieves. They were slaves, likely escaped from this very plantation and looking to throw off the scent of the dogs by making off with our boat. Gentry was roused by the commotion and helped Abe chase the remaining slaves into the woods. Satisfied they wouldn't return for the moment, they cut the flatboat loose and took their chances navigating the Mississippi at night. We set out, Alan holding our lantern at the bow and squinting into the night, me working the steering oar from atop our shelter, trying to keep us dead down the middle. I could not help but steal a look at the bank, and as I did, I saw a white figure running toward the river from the plantation. Here was the first of the overseers come to reclaim his slaves. But this man, this tiny white figure, did not stop running at the river's edge. He jumped to the opposite bank in one long, impossible leap. They did not run from men or dogs. They ran from a vampire. I thought briefly of steering us into the muddy bank, of taking the bundle from under my bed and giving chase. I cannot say whether I thought the attempt hopeless or the victims worthless. I can say only that I did not stop. Alan, it now dawning on him how perilously close he had come to having his throat cut, presently let forth a stream of profanity, the likes of which I had never heard, and much of which I did not understand, cursing himself for failing to bring a musket along, condemning those murderous sons of bitches. I remained silent, focused only on keeping us dead down the middle. I could not bring myself to hate our attackers, for it occurred to me that they were merely trying to preserve their lives. In doing so, they had thought it necessary to deprive me of mine. Alan went on, something about no good black something or others. "Judge them not equally," I said. 2. Alan and Abe reached New Orleans at midday on June 20th, twisting round the ever-tightening bends of the Mississippi as they neared its center, where they would be able to sell their remaining goods, and sell their boat for lumber, at any number of busy wharves. A light rain greeted them, welcome relief from the oppressive humidity that had dogged so much of their trip downriver. The north of the city presented itself first, sprawling and lively. Farms became houses, houses became streets, streets became two-story brick buildings with iron railings on their balconies. So many sailing ships, so many steamboats, flatboats numbering in the hundreds, all clamoring for their little piece of the great river. New Orleans was a city of 40,000, and the South's gateway to the world. Walking along its wharves, one was likely to encounter sailors from every corner of Europe and South America, even some from the Orient. We could not be rid of our cargo quickly enough. How we longed to explore the city of endless wonders! I was all astonishment, for I had never in my life seen such multitudes, their tongues dripping with French and Spanish phrases, ladies fanning themselves in the latest fashions, and gentlemen clad from head to toe in suits of the highest quality. Streets filled with horses and carts, merchants selling everywhere imagined. We strolled the Rue de Chartres, beheld the Basilica of St. Louis in Jackson Square, so named for our president's heroic defense of the city. Here, teams of men and mules dug trenches for gas pipes. When their months of work were finished, one of them proudly sang, "The city would gleam like a sparkling jewel in the night, with nary a torch or a candle in sight." Abe was struck by the liveliness of the city and its people. He was also struck by the age of things around him. I imagined myself conveyed to those places in Europe that I had read so often about. Here, for the first time in my life, were homes with ivy-covered walls. Here were men of letters, architecture, and art. Here were vast libraries filled with eager students and appreciative patrons. Here were all the things that my father would never understand. Marie Laveau's boarding house on St. Claude Street was hardly the most impressive of the city's Spanish-style buildings, but it was good enough for a pair of Indiana flatboatmen to rest their heads for a week. There was a saloon not far from Ms. Laveau's where one could have his fill of rum or wine or whiskey. Flush with money from selling our goods and our boat, and flush with the excitement of being in such a city for the first time, I admit we indulged in these, more even than a pair of young, foolish men should have. The saloon was overfilled with sailors from all parts of the world, flatboatmen from every point on the Mississippi, Ohio, and Sangamon. A brawl seemed to break out every third minute. It is a wonder they did not break out more frequently. Surly boatmen weren't the only strange characters Abe encountered during his first 24 hours in New Orleans. The following morning, as he and Alan stumbled through the streets in search of an inoffensive breakfast, clutching their aching heads and shielding their eyes from the sun, Abe spotted something incredible coming toward them on Bienville Street. A coach of lustrous white, pulled by a pair of white horses, and driven by a boy wearing a coat of the same color. Behind him sat a pair of gentlemen, one cherubic and red-cheeked, his suit an unremarkable blend of greens and grays. The other wore a suit of white silk, a compliment to his fair skin and long white hair, his eyes hidden behind dark glasses. He was as obvious a vampire as I had ever laid eyes upon, and by all appearances, the wealthiest. Elegant and refined, unencumbered by shadows, free to mingle as he pleased, and laughing. He and the living gentleman were in the midst of what looked a very cheerful conversation. I could think only of staking him through the heart as his coach neared, of chopping off his head. How the blood would look against the white silk of his coat. Alas, I could only watch him, restrained by the absence of weapons and the presence of an aching head. The white-haired vampire gave me a knowing look as he passed. And then the strangest feeling, the feeling of invading eyes reading the pages of my journal, the sound of a voice with no source. Judge us not equally, Abraham. They turned onto Dauphine Street and were gone, but the feeling of invading eyes remained. This time the source was plain as day. I spotted a pale little fellow across the street, half hidden in an alley, his eyes unquestionably fixed on me. He was dressed entirely in black, with a mess of hair to match, and a small mustache beneath his dark glasses. Unmistakably a vampire. Seeing that he had been discovered, the figure turned and disappeared into the alley. This I could not leave uninvestigated. Aching head be damned. I left my friend to his own stumbling and hastened after the stranger, chasing him down the alley to Conti Street, then across Basin Street, where the devil sought refuge behind the cemetery walls. Footnote: Abe is referring to what is today called St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. I had been no more than 10 paces behind him, but on reaching the gates, I perceived him not. He had vanished, lost in a maze of crypts. I wondered if he had simply slipped into one of them, wondered how many vampires were. "And what mean you by chasing me so, sir?" I spun around and raised my fists. He was behind me, his back against the inside of the cemetery wall. Clever devil. Staring at me, his dark glasses in his fingers, his tired eyes and high forehead. "Chasing you, sir?" I said. "What meant you by running?" "Well, sir, the manner in which you shielded your eyes from the light, the familiar glance you shared with the gentleman in the coach, I thought you a vampire." I could scarcely believe what I had heard. "You thought me a vampire?" he asked. "But I..." A smile grew over the little man's lips. He looked at the dark glasses in his fingers, at the look on this tall stranger's face. He began to laugh. "I believe us both guilty of grave misjudgments." "Forgive me, sir, but am I to understand that you are not a vampire?" "Regrettably, no," he said, laughing, "or I should still have my breath." I offered my apology and extended my hand. "Abe Lincoln." The little man took it. "Edgar Poe." 3. Abraham Lincoln and Edgar Allan Poe were born within weeks of each other. Both lost their mothers as children. Otherwise, their upbringings couldn't have been more different. After his mother's death, Poe had been taken in by a wealthy merchant, John Allen, who dealt in slaves, among other commodities. Whisked away from his native Boston, he'd been thoroughly educated in some of England's finest schools. He'd seen the wonders of Europe that Abe could only read about in books. Around the time Abe swore his vengeance against vampires and staked Jack Bartz through the heart, Edgar Allan Poe returned to America, settling with his adoptive father in Virginia, and enjoying all the luxuries associated with belonging to one of its wealthiest families. Poe had everything Abe could ever want, the finest education, the finest homes, more books than he could count, a father with no want of ambition. But he and Abe were equally miserable creatures. As a first-year student at the University of Virginia, Poe drank and gambled away every penny his foster father sent him, until John Allen finally cut him off. Enraged and abandoned, he fled Virginia for Boston and enlisted in the army under the name Edgar A. Perry, loading artillery shells by day and writing ever darker stories and poems by candlelight. It was here, while stationed in the city of his birth, that Edgar Allan Poe met his first vampire. Using his own money, Poe published a short collection of poems, identifying himself only as a Bostonian on its cover, for fear of being mocked by his fellow enlisted men. Of the 50 he paid to have printed, fewer than 20 sold. Notwithstanding this poor reception, one reader saw a particular genius in Poe's collection, and bribed its printer to learn the author's true identity.
"It was shortly after this that I was visited upon by a Mr. Guy de Vere, a widower of considerable means. He explained how he had come to learn my name, and that he had been much affected by my work. He then demanded to know what a vampire was doing serving in the army."
Guy de Vere was convinced that only a vampire could have written poems with such an outlook on death and grief, poems of such darkness and beauty.
"He was surprised, then, to find a living man their creator. I was likewise surprised to find myself speaking to a man who was no longer living."
Poe was endlessly fascinated by the stately, blood-sucking de Vere, and de Vere by the gloomy, brilliant Poe. The two struck up a tenuous friendship, much as Henry and Abe had done. But Poe wasn't interested in learning about vampires to better hunt them. He wanted to know about the experience of living in darkness, of moving beyond death, so that he could better write about it. De Vere was all too happy to oblige, with the understanding that Poe would never reveal his identity in print. Footnote: an understanding Poe seemed to have forgotten by 1843, when De Vere was used as a character in Poe's Lenore. Several months after making De Vere's acquaintance, Poe's regiment was assigned to Fort Moultrie in South Carolina. With no city to satisfy his appetite for culture, and no means of satisfying his thirst for further vampire knowledge, the army suddenly seemed a prison. Therefore, he had decided to grant himself an unofficial leave and come to New Orleans for the stated purpose of studying vampires, for De Vere had insisted there was not a better place in America to do so. Judging by the number of times he filled and emptied his whiskey glass, he had also come to drink himself to death. We sat that evening in the saloon near Mrs. Laveau's. Alan Gentry had gone off to consort with ladies of a certain character, leaving us free to talk on that subject we enjoyed most, but dared not discuss freely. We spoke well into the night, sharing everything we had read and heard, and witnessed firsthand regarding vampires. "How then do they learn to feed?" asked Abe as the barkeep swept the empty tavern around them. "How do they know to shy away from the
How does a calf know to stand? A honeybee to build a hive?"
Poe took another drink.
"It is their nature, beautiful and simple, that you would destroy such beings, Mr. Lincoln, such superior creatures, seems madness to me."
"That you speak of them with such reverence, Mr. Poe, seems madness to me."
"Can you imagine it? Can you imagine seeing the universe through such eyes? Laughing in the face of time and death, the world your Garden of Eden, your library, your harem?"
"Yes, I can also imagine a want of companionship and a want of peace."
"Well, I can imagine a want of nothing. Think of the fortune one could amass, the comforts one could afford, the wonders of the world one could see at his leisure."
"And when this intoxication is worn away, when every desire is fulfilled and every language learned, when there are no more distant cities to explore, no classics to be studied, not another coin to be stuffed into one's coffers, what then? One can have all the comforts of the world, but what use are they if there is no comfort in them?" Abe shared a folk tale, one that he had first heard from a traveler on the old Cumberland Road. "There was once a man who yearned to live forever. Beginning in his youth, he prayed for God to grant him immortality. He was charitable and earnest,
honest in his business dealings, true to his wife and kind to his children. He humbled himself before God, and he preached his laws to all who would listen. And yet, he continued to age with every passing year, until he finally died a frail old man. When he reached heaven, he asked, "Lord, why did you refuse to answer my prayer? Did I not live my life according to your word? Did I not praise your name to all who would listen?" To which God replied, "You did all of these things, and that is why I did not curse you by answering your prayer." "You speak of eternal life. You speak of indulging the mind and body," said Abe. "But what of the soul?" "And what use is a soul to a creature that shall never die?" Abe couldn't help but smile. Here was a strange little man with a strange way of seeing things. Only the second living man he'd ever met who knew the truth of vampires. He drank to excess and spoke in an irritating, high-pitched voice. It was hard not to like him. "I begin to suspect," said Abe, "that you would like to be one of them." Poe laughed at the suggestion. "Is not our existence long and miserable enough?" he asked, laughing. "Who in God's name would seek to prolong it?" 4. On the following afternoon, June 22nd, Abe wandered along St. Philip Street by himself. Alan Gentry hadn't returned from whatever depravities he'd enjoyed the night before, and Poe had staggered off to his own boarding house at dawn. After sleeping half the day away, Abe had decided that some fresh air and a stroll were desperately needed to chase the fog from his mind and bitter taste from his mouth. "I happened upon some great commotion in the street as I neared the river. A large crowd gathered around a platform, which had been decorated in reds and whites and blues. A yellow banner flew above this makeshift stage, upon which were the words, 'Slave auction today, 1 o'clock. More than 100 men were crowded in front of the platform. More than twice that number of Negroes milled about nearby. Pipe smoke choked the air as prospective buyers mingled, the rare laugh breaking through the din, their pencils and papers held ready as the hour neared. The auctioneer, a man every ounce as plump and pink as a hog, then stepped before them and began, 'Honored gentlemen, I am pleased to present the day's first lot.' Upon this, the first Negro, a man of perhaps 35 years, took the stage and bowed heartily, smiling and standing tall in his ill-fitting suit, which looked to have been purchased for the occasion. 'A bull, name a cuff, still in the prime of his strength, as fine a field hand as you are ever likely to see, and sure to sire a brood of sons with backs every bit as sound.' That this bull seemed so fervent in his hope of being bought, standing up straight, smiling and bowing as the auctioneer described his many uses, I could not help my pity and revulsion. The rest of this man's life, all the future generations of his progeny, all of it rested on this moment, all of it in the hands of a man he had never met, a man willing to pay the highest price. All told, there were more than 200 slaves scheduled to be auctioned over a 2-day period. For a week leading up to the sale, they'd been held in a pair of barns where prospective buyers had been free to come and inspect them. This inspection involved all manner of invasion and humiliation. Men, women, and children, ages 3 years to 75, were made to stand bare before strangers. Their muscles were pulled at, their mouths pried open, and their teeth inspected. They were made to walk and bend and lift, lest they be concealing any lameness. They were made to list their talents, to assist in driving up their own price. This ran counter to their own interests, for the higher the price, the less likely they would ever be able to save enough money to buy their freedom from the kind masters who allowed them to do so. Footnote: a healthy man in his prime could fetch as much as $1,100, an impossible amount for a slave to bank, while an older woman, or those with any sort of impediment, might net $100 or less. The theater of it all, men and women, children and infants presented to this surly mob,
this collection of so-called gentlemen. I saw a Negro girl of 3 or 4 clinging to her mother, confused as to why she was dressed in such clothes, why she had been scrubbed the night before, made to stand on this platform while men shouted numbers and waved pieces of paper in the air. Again, I wondered why a creator who had dreamt such beauty would have slandered it with such evil. If Lincoln saw any irony in the fact that he had come downriver to sell goods to many of these same plantation owners, he never wrote of it.
"Gentlemen, I now ask your attention to be turned to a fine specimen of family if ever there was. The bull by name of Israel, his teeth of the regular sort, and his build uncommonly large. You shall not find a better planter of rice in this or any parish. His wife, Beatrice, with arms and back almost as strong as that of a man's, yet hands delicate enough to mend a lady's dress. Their children, a boy of 10 or 11 years, fated to become as strong a worker as his father, and a girl of 4, her face as sweet as an angel's. You shall never find 4 better specimens."
Each slave followed his own sale with keen interest, his eyes darting around as each bid was shouted out. If he was purchased by a master with a reputation for kindness, or one who had purchased some of his near relations, he would leave the stage with something like contentment, even joy, on his face. But if he was sold to a man who seemed especially cruel, or knew that he would never see his loved ones again, the quiet anguish on his face was indescribable. One buyer in particular drew my interest, a man whose pocketbook seemed bottomless and whose purchases seemed senseless. He arrived at the auction after it had begun, this alone was unusual, and snapped up a dozen slaves with seemingly no regard for their sex or health or skills. In fact, he seemed interested only in those Negroes described as bargains. But his purchases were only part of the reason he drew my suspicion. He was a slender man in a fine waist-length coat, shorter than I, though still quite tall, with a graying beard meant to conceal the scar that ran the length of his face, from his left eye across his lips to his chin. He held a parasol to shade himself from the sun, and wore dark glasses over his eyes. If he was not a vampire, he certainly admired their fashion. What was the meaning of it? Why had he purchased 2 older women of similar abilities? A boy with a lame leg? Why did he need so many slaves at all? I resolved to follow him and find the answer.
5. 12 slaves walked barefoot, winding their way north on a muddy road that traced the Mississippi. They were male and female, ranging from 14 to 66 years of age. Some had known each other their whole lives. Some had only met an hour or two before. Each of the 12 had a rope around their waist connecting them to the others. In front of this convoy, their new gray-bearded master. Behind it, a white overseer, his rifle ready to cut down any slave who dared to run. Both men rode comfortably on horseback. Abe was careful to keep his distance as they wound their way through the woods. I walked a quarter of a mile behind the group, close enough to hear the overseer's occasional barking, but far enough for my careful footfalls to escape the ears of a vampire. Night had begun to fall by the time they reached a plantation 8 miles north of the city, and a mile from the east bank of the river. It looked no different than any of the plantations I had seen up and down the Mississippi. A blacksmith's shop, a tanning yard, a grist mill, storehouses, machinery, looms, sheds, stables, and some 25 slave quarters surrounding the planter's house. These were one-room cabins where a dozen Negroes might live together, sleeping on dirt floors or corn husk beds, their pine torches burning so the women could tend to their quilting work long into the night. By day, the dark fields around me would be filled with noise and work, gangs of 100 men digging trenches in long rows, women driving plows in the searing heat, the white overseers riding among them on horseback, looking for the slightest offense to punish by flogging their naked backs. In the center of it all stood the master's house. Those slaves fortunate enough to work here were spared the backbreaking toil of the fields, but by no means was theirs an easy existence, for they were just as likely to be flogged for the slightest transgression. Furthermore, female slaves of any age might well find themselves at the mercy of masters' unspeakable whims.
Abe kept his distance as the 12 slaves were led past the Maison Principale and into a large barn, the inside lit by torches and hanging oil lamps. Hiding behind a shed some 20 yards away, he had a clear view through the open doors. Here, they were joined by a large Negro, the master and overseer having adjourned to the house. He held a whip, which he had cracked at the new arrivals while ordering them to form a line in the center of the barn. Thus arranged, they were made to sit, still joined at the waist by rope. A mulatto woman presently appeared carrying a large basket under her arm, this only serving to increase the apprehension of the newly arrived, for they had doubtless heard stories of slaves being branded by new masters. Happily, the basket was stuffed with food, to which the 12 slaves were instructed to help themselves freely. I watched their eyes shine at the sight of fried pork and corn cakes, of cow's milk and handfuls of sugar candies. I saw such relief on their faces, for until this moment they had been unsure of what cruelties awaited. They could hardly fill their starving bellies fast enough. Abe wondered if he had been too hasty in his suspicion. Henry proved that there were vampires capable of kindness, of restraint. Had these slaves been bought for the purpose of being freed? At the very least, would they be treated with compassion? This feast having gone on for what seemed a half hour, I watched a party of white men walk from the house to the barn. There were 10 in all, including the master I had followed from New Orleans. Each varied in age and build, though all looked to be men of some means. On their reaching the barn, the large Negro again cracked his whip and ordered the slaves to their feet and set about removing the rope from around their waists. The mulatto woman collected her basket and made off with no want of haste. The white men having assembled near the entrance, one of them handed something to his host, certainly papers of some sort, I suspect they were banknotes, and approached the line of slaves. I watched him pace back and forth, examining each one, until at last he stopped behind an older, thick-set woman and waited. One by one, each of the 8 others handed his tribute to their host, examined the remaining slaves, and picked his own to wait behind, until all 9 guests were in place. The Negroes dared not turn around. Their eyes remained fixed on the ground at their feet. 9 of the slaves now being spoken for, the large Negro led the other 3 out of the barn and into the dark. What became of these poor souls, I cannot say. I can only speak to the anxiety I felt as they disappeared, for something was about to happen. What it was, I knew not. I knew only that it would be dreadful. He was correct. Satisfied that the other slaves were out of earshot, the gray-bearded host gave a whistle. Upon this, 9 pairs of eyes turned black, 9 sets of fangs descended, and 9 vampires tore into their helpless prey from behind. The first vampire grabbed the sides of the thick-set woman's head and twisted it backwards so that her chin and spine met, his wretched face her dying sight. Another screamed and writhed when she felt the sting of 2 fangs in her shoulder, but the greater her struggle, the deeper the wound became, and the more freely her precious blood poured into the creature's mouth. I saw the head of a boy beaten until his brains poured from a hole in his skull, and another man's head taken entirely. I could do nothing to help them. Not when there were so many. Not without a weapon. The slave master calmly pulled the barn doors closed to stifle the noises of death, and I ran into the night, my face wet with tears, disgusted with myself for being so helpless, sickened by what I had seen, but more than anything, sickened by the truth taking shape in my mind. A truth that I had been too blind to see before. Abe purchased a black leather-bound journal on Dauphine Street the next day. His first entry, while a scant 17 words, was a powerful statement of that truth and one of the most important sentences he would ever write. June 25, 1828.
So long as this country is cursed with slavery, so too will it be cursed with vampires. Part 2. Vampire Hunter. 5. New Salem. The way for a young man to rise is to improve himself every way he can, never suspecting that anybody wishes to hinder him. Abraham Lincoln, in a letter to William Herndon, July 10, 1848. 1. Abe was shaking. It was a bitter cold February night, and he'd been waiting for a man to put his clothes on for the better of 2 hours. Abe paced back and forth in the hard-packed snow, throwing the occasional glance toward the unfinished courthouse on the other side of the square, and at the second floor of the saloon across the street, where a light still burned behind the curtained window of a whore. He passed the time with thoughts of his weeks spent floating shirtless down the Mississippi in unbearable heat. Heat a man could drown in. He thought of mornings spent splitting rails in the shade, afternoons cooling off with a swim in the creek. But those memories were all more than 3 years and 200 miles away. Tonight, on his 22nd birthday, he was freezing on the empty streets of Calhoun, Illinois. Footnote: the town would be renamed Springfield the following year. Thomas Lincoln had finally given up on Indiana. He'd been receiving regular reports from John Hanks, a cousin of Abe's mother, regarding the untapped wonders of Illinois. John wrote of the plentiful and fertile prairies of that state, of flat land that needed no clearing, free of rocks, and to be had cheap. It was all the incentive Thomas needed to leave Indiana and its bitter memories behind. In March of 1830, the Lincolns packed their belongings into 3 wagons, each hitched to a team of oxen, and left Little Pigeon Creek forever. For 15 exhausting days, they navigated mud-covered roads and forded icy rivers, until at last we reached Macon County and settled just west of Decatur, smack dab in the center of Illinois. Abe was 21 then. It had been 2 years since he'd witnessed the slave massacre in New Orleans, 2 years of handing hard-earned wages over to his father. Now he was finally free to strike out on his own. Despite being desperate to do so, Abe stayed on an extra year, helping his father build a new cabin and helping his family settle into their new home. But tonight he was 22, and so help him, it was to be his last birthday under his father's roof. My stepbrother John was the one who insisted we ride to Calhoun to celebrate. I wouldn't hear of it at first, not being one to make a fuss over the occasion. As usual, he nagged at me until I could tolerate no more. He stated his intentions while on our ride to town, which, as I recall, was amounting to getting blind stinking drunk and buying you the company of a woman friend.